Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn Semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 12, delivered on September 24, 2009. The title of this lecture is The Metrics of Risk.
Today, The Metrics of Risk. On Tuesday, I brought up standard deviation, which is a basic measure of volatility. And we can write it in something like this. Look, the first thing, if we had a distribution, probabilities and the expected cash flow for each probability, we would first of all want to get the expected value, the mu, the mean, the average. And it's a weighted average. It's the fancy formula for it is the sum across the states of the probability of each state times the cash flow for each state. And I write cash flow, CF sub I here, but it could be like sales, it could be operating income, it could be net income, it's whatever you're looking at in a given problem, but I just write CF sub I there, cash flow sub I. Which actually, in real financial analysis, we're mostly interested in that cash flow, but one way or the other. That's our mean, our average, the expected. But the expected isn't going to happen, probably. So the next metric that we use is the standard deviation, the spread, the width, the central tendency, perhaps. And that one is the sum from I equals 1 to n of the probability of each state, I, times the state minus the mean squared, and then you take the square root of that whole mess. And this can be a long calculation. One way that I, by the way, something you might want to do to speed up a calculation like this is once you've got the mean, store that in your calculator's memory register, in the first memory register. Just store it. And then it saves you. You can then do each state minus recall 1 squared times the probability and work your way down like that. It'll save you a little time if you store that mean once you've got it. Make sure you've got the right mean. And as I've pointed out to you, if you make a mistake in this, then it all just kind of blows apart. So walk carefully as you're doing this. Now the last metric, and I shall stipulate here that I could not remember what I was forgetting on Tuesday. The last metric is the coefficient of variation, CV, which is the standard deviation over the mean. It is a way to standardize so that you can compare cash flows or whatever it is, sales across companies or across years. It's a way to sort of standardize these measures so that you get a percentage number that you can compare from one company to another, the coefficient of variation, the CV. And we focused on this one. In high-powered probability and statistics, they will poo-poo coefficient of variation. But in business finance, we actually use this all the time. The CV is one of our favorites. Because it's sort of a standard basic measure of the volatility of whatever it is you're looking at. Now, when I keep saying cash flow, we could talk about volatility risk of sales. We could talk about the volatility risk of operating income. That's EBIT. Or we could even talk about the volatility of net income. Now, these won't necessarily all be the same volatility. Interestingly enough, there are things that can cause them to diverge from each other. Now, the volatility of operating income would be about the same as the volatility of sales. I could calculate the coefficient of variation, and you'd get about the same number as long as all you had were variable costs that were separating sales from operating income. If the costs of the firm were all attached to the sales so that they move together, that won't make the operating income's volatility different from the sales volatility. If those two are moving together, if there's like just minus variable expenses and they're always just kind of like the same percentage of sales, they'll just rock together. And so your operating income volatility would look very much like your sales volatility. They would look the same. And this weekend I'll give you a problem where you'll just do a sales volatility and then you'll just look at take away some variable costs and look at operating income volatility. You'll say, oh, well, there's not a difference or not much difference in the volatilities. It doesn't do anything. If all you've got is something that's moving along with it, there's not going to be much change. Think about it this way. You and I are attached by a steel pole, and we are riding on a violent roller coaster. You're in one car and I'm in another. If we're attached by a steel pole, then there's going to be no noticeable change between you and me in what happens to us, right? We're going to move together in synchrony. Now, you might be like variable costs and I might be the sales. So if you're moving along with me, it doesn't cause much change in what we experience, okay? However, what's odd is that if you put in fixed costs that hold, that do not change, operating income starts to swing more than sales do. But as long as it's just variable costs, operating income will have the same volatility as sales. And that's just plain old what we call business risk, just basic business risk, the volatility of sales. And so that business risk won't change if all you have is variable costs. But if I have fixed costs involved, then things change. The net income's volatility gets worse. Think about it this way. Now suppose that I am standing on the ground and we're attached by an elastic pole. I'm fixed to the ground and you're up there swinging that roller coaster. You're going to be pulled around harder because I'm fixed on the ground. You're going to notice a pull that's going to cause you to swing, at least to feel like you're swinging, a lot harder because I'm sitting there holding on the ground. Not rocking with you. I'm holding on the ground. That's not going to stabilize you. As you go up and down, that's going to pull you harder. You're going to feel swings that you didn't feel when we were rolling together. I know this is the stupidest ass example in the world, but it actually gives you a sense of what's going on here. If you put fixed costs in there, before you get to that operating income line, you get more volatility at the operating line. We call that minus variable costs. If that's all it is, then no difference in business risk. In other words, CV, coefficient of variation. You'll see that. If all it is variable costs separating sales from operating income will have no different business risk. You'll see no different business risk from the business risk that is at the sales line. However, if you put in fixed costs, if suddenly this thing has both variable costs and fixed costs, before you get to the operating income line, suddenly this and this are going to be different. Different CVs. The business risk you see at the operating income line will be more than the business risk that was showing up purely at the sales line. We call the contribution of fixed costs to more business risk operating leverage. Now, interestingly, the book doesn't quite bring this up. It brings it up for another kind of leverage called financial leverage, but it doesn't bring it up for operating leverage. But I'll tell you something that you can do here is if you look at sales minus variable costs, if you just look at your CV without the fixed costs, and then you look at the CV with the fixed costs, you can see the contribution of operating leverage. Let me explain. CV without fixed costs. Now you take that away from the CV with fixed costs, and you will see the effect of operating leverage. On total business risk. In other words, without the fixed cost there, your operating income will have the volatility of your sales income. That's just plain business risk, the whipsaws of sales, okay? And if there's variable costs, just the whipsaws, the variable costs aren't going to do anything. But you look at that, then you look at it with the fixed costs in there. You'll see that the coefficient of variation will be bigger. Your business risk is bigger. So you can then say, okay, now I can take the business, the total business risk with the fixed costs minus the total business risk without fixed costs, and I'll see the operating leverage effect. How much those fixed costs were whipping us around. Here's the bottom line of that. Here's the bottom line of that. Companies that have our heavy fixed costs, they will have operating leverage. Their business risk, all other things being equal, should be somewhat more than companies that are light on the fixed capital. So that would tell you, okay, companies that are manufacturing, industrial companies, they would have, everything else being equal, more business risk than companies that are like consulting companies or service companies. Why? Because those manufacturing companies would have big fixed costs, heavy duty fixed costs, which contribute operating leverage, therefore magnifying the overall business risk. Fixed costs are almost like a lens. The fixed costs are almost like a lens. These two together create a business risk and a volatility. But the fixed costs are sort of like a lens that magnifies the volatility up here so that the final volatility is heavier. And so we would say that there would be more overall business risk because of operating leverage in companies that have high fixed costs, that are heavy on the fixed costs. And so, but again, the book doesn't really bring this up right here. It does for another kind of risk. But you can look at it, and I'll certainly, you'll see a problem like this I'll give you this weekend. You'll see, oh, well, the CV does go up if there are fixed costs in this. The coefficient of variation is actually being magnified by that thing that's on the ground holding you so that when you're trying to go up and down, you're being pulled as you go up and down. So the volatility is greater. Now, here's the last part of this, is that you get operating income, and then there's obviously minus your interest, minus your taxes to get to your net income. Well, interest, you see, is a fixed cost. You pay it or you're out of business. Interest is a fixed cost. Okay, are we okay on that? You will pay your interest, and it will be a fixed amount. It doesn't change with your sales, doesn't change with anything. You will pay your bondholders, your debt holders. Well, that would mean that it would act like fixed costs above the operating income line. It would magnify risk. In fact, that one we separate out completely and give it its own title. We call that financial risk. Financial risk, which is, and well, I'll just write it this way. The CV at the operating line of business risk, whatever that business risk is, whether it has operating leverage or not in it, minus, oh, I'm sorry, CV at the net line. Minus the CV of business risk. So in other words, you get your coefficient of your net income. Coefficient of variation of the net income. Okay, now, if there are no interest expenses, that will be the same as your business risk. That will be the same as your business risk. If there's no interest being paid, then there's no new fixed cost between operating income and net. Therefore, you will not have any difference in the two CVs. But if there is interest expense, when you get your operating income minus interest expense, minus your taxes, but those should be variable with, that should be variable. Your your taxes should be varying with your EBT. So that'd be a variable. It's a little bit clumpy, so you might get a little bit of a change, but not much. EBT minus taxes would be your net income, okay? So we can ignore this tax effect because it should be a variable cost rolling with the EBT. So it shouldn't affect the CV. However, that interest expense does because it's a fixed. So that means that that thing right there is going to be the financial leverage. The financial leverage creator. Let me put it this way. Cause of financial leverage. If there's any interest expense, it's fixed. Therefore, it magnifies. And so if we do the coefficient of variation at the net line minus the coefficient of variation from pure business risk, whether or not it has operating leverage in it or not, we'll see the effect of the financial leverage. We'll see the effect of the financial leverage that is being caused. Notice something. Do you remember Amazon.com? We did the Amazon.com statements. You remember those? Did you see how Amazon was avoiding debt, getting out of the business of debt, deleveraging itself? Well, there you go. Clearly, they are trying to reduce financial leverage. They are trying to get their total risk, their overall risk at the net income line, closer to pure business risk. Closer to pure business risk. Do you follow me on that? They, as they get rid of debt and interest on debt, they are trying to close in, get closer to just pure business risk, which is operating income. Because if there's no interest, the operating income risk should be approximately the net income risk. By getting rid of the interest expense, essentially, they are trying to reduce the volatility of their bottom line. And that's what you're doing there. See, that net interest expense is creating volatility at the bottom line that is aside from the volatility of at the operating income line. By getting rid of debt, getting rid of expense, you are then stabilizing your cash flow. Now, I don't know if I can do this too well. Some of you may have noticed it, maybe you didn't. But if you make a certain amount of money, and you're not all that sure you'll make the how your income will be from 1 year to the next, maybe even 1 month to the next, if you don't owe any debts, fixed debts, you're a lot more assured that you're going to be okay from 1 month to the next to the next, from 1 year to the next to the next. But if you have things you have to pay, they're fixed costs, that makes for more uncertainty at the bottom line of your life. Because then, oh God, I hope my income is enough to cover all my bills. But if you don't have any fixed bills, what the hell do you care? I mean, if you live, okay, after college, you go live with mom in the basement. She takes care of the Cheetos and pays for the DSL so that you can play World of Warcraft. She washes your clothes. You have no debts. You have no worries, man. But then you go out there, you get yourself a job. You get yourself a fixed payment on a house or a lease on a lease can do, leases will do the same thing. It's fixed. A lease is like a fixed. You have all these fixed things that you have to pay. You have to pay your alimony every month. Your child support for the 8 kids. I mean, dude, your life sucks. And that's the way you're all going to be. Right now, you're very comfortable. And 20 years from now, you're going to look back on this. Oh, man, this that was so good. Uh-huh. And part of that is just that internal sense of the volatility that has been created in your life. The uncertainty of whether you're going to be okay to the next day, to the next month, to the next year. Because you've got fixed expenses. If you hadn't gone out and had all those kids, you know, it would have been a lot better for you. So you see, interestingly enough, and as those fixed expenses become a larger part of your, take on a dominance in your operating income, oh God, it's terrible. And as your debts get to be, the interest you pay on debts gets to be more a part of your bottom line, it begins to create all kinds of uncertainty, all kinds of concerns for you, purely because of an internal sense of the greater risk that you are bearing. And that's why we do these CVs. In businesses, we actually are excited about knowing how much risk we are actually contributing to the company by taking on fixed costs, which add to business risk. By taking on interest expense, which puts financial risk into the bottom line of the total risk of the company. And that's why we care about these. And that's why we will look at these things like, well, yeah, it'd be great to borrow money to do this project because of the gains to leverage, but we also create more risk for the company because of that debt. And when we think about a company like Amazon.com, interesting thing, if you remember those financials, do you remember how the fixed assets were going up in the company? There was a clear indication the fixed assets were rising in the company. Well, that would create fixed costs through shareholder, by having to pay your shareholders possibly. But you don't have to pay your shareholders a dividend. You don't have to. It's like a discretionary fixed cost. Amazon.com chooses not to pay that dividend, not to create that expectation yet in their shareholders. And notice how by not letting their shareholders expect that, they are avoiding creating a fixed expense. So they are, in that sense, controlling their overall volatility, their overall risk of their company. That's what it's all about. Now, again, these are all driven by the CVs, and you get the CVs by getting the sigma, by getting the mu and the sigma. That's all this is about. It's just calculating, doing the probability distribution, calculating it, and then calculating it for the sales line, calculating it for the operating income line, calculating it for the net income line, all those. That's all this is about to get the CVs. And you'll see a practical problem. I'll put one up this weekend with some guidance for it. The last metric of risk, before I back off, is the one called beta. Beta is the measure of the non-diversifiable risk of a security. And that security, it could be a stock, it could be a bond, it could be a project, it could be a portfolio of securities. It's merely our measure, our metric of non-diversifiable risk, the risk that you cannot get rid of. Because as you acquire stocks, what will happen is that stocks will have ups and downs, but it would be amazing if you could find two stocks that had the same exact ups and downs. Stocks will tend to have differences. They're not perfectly correlated. And because they're not perfectly correlated, taken together, they smooth out each other's volatility. The less correlated they are, the more negatively correlated, I should say, the more they'll smooth out each other's volatility. If you get enough stocks into a portfolio, you will nearly wipe out any unusual volatility of a given stock in the portfolio. If you put 20 stocks together in a portfolio, you're going to knock out 95% of the weird variations of the portfolio. Follow with me on this. Follow with me. Let me see. Okay, let me see this. The volatility of prices of stocks are not, they're not perfect. Not perfect. But there's also, that would mean that they will smooth each other out. That smoothing out is getting rid of the diversifiable risk. The smoothing out is getting rid of the diversifiable risk. When you buy a couple of stocks, as long as they don't just go perfectly together, they're going to cancel each other's volatilities out. They're going to cancel each other's volatilities out, at least to some extent. And then if you put in more stocks, you'll get more of that canceling effect. At the end of the day, though, interestingly enough, if you put a whole pile of stocks together, they won't cancel out all of the volatility, because underneath it, they're all going to have at least a small component of their volatility that will be because of the macroeconomic factors that affect all companies the same. There will be a little bit of positive correlation after you have taken into account all of the smoothing out effect. There's going to be a small amount of positive correlation, even if you've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stocks. That small amount of positive correlation is because all of those stocks have some factors that are affecting them the same way. Some factors. Macroeconomic factors, global factors, in fact, will do this too. And that's why anymore you do want to talk about globalizing your portfolios to some extent. Now, here's the thing. What am I talking about when I'm talking about a well-diversified portfolio? Like I said, you get 20 stocks together, you've got 95% of diversification's benefit. 95% of it at 20. 30, you're doing much better. Here's the thing, though. You buy one stock because you've got a great idea, you're out of your friggin' mind. Because you've got so much volatility there, no one's going to reward you for that volatility, because that volatility can be removed by diversifying the portfolio. Two stocks, three stocks, you're still bearing enormous volatility. When these guys recommend on these television shows, well, I'm recommending that you buy this stock because... Where? How do you do that? Why would you buy a single security unless you can talk about that in the context of a broad, diversified portfolio? Don't talk about one security. You're recommending that people take on stupid risk because you're talking about the volatility, that a lot of that volatility has nothing whatsoever to do with the economy. Now, if you want to take a side bet, great. But you still are impacting on the total risk that that person is going to bear. And a lot of that risk, there's no market that's going to reward the person for that. So what would be the best choice? Okay, mutual funds. There's a great way, because a mutual fund will buy a whole pile of stocks and then will give you the benefit of the diversification. If you want more diversification, go into a couple of mutual funds. Because in the mutual fund managers are going to diversify the portfolio, shake out as much risk as possible, shake out the diversifiable risk to the extent possible, and then the rest, then you are buying into that mutual fund. You've got the benefit of the diversification of a portfolio, and you don't have to buy 20, 30, 40, 50 stocks to do it. And then there are, like I said, you can actually buy a couple of mutual funds and get even more diversification that way. But buying single stocks on your own, you're nuts. You're just absolutely nuts, because there's so much volatility in there. If you buy a couple more securities, you're going to smooth out that volatility. No market's going to reward you for that kind of risk that you're taking with just a single security. Look. The widest portfolio, the biggest portfolio you could talk about, would be what we call the market portfolio, where you purchase every security, every stock, in its proportion to its total capitalization, its contribution to the whole economy. That would be the ideal market portfolio, is this ginormous, I buy every stock there is, and its proportion of my portfolio is the same as its contribution to the overall economy. Now, that's, of course, kind of ridiculous to do that. And like I said, you don't have to buy something that is theoretically that crazy. You can do a mutual fund and get a lot of the benefit of the market portfolio. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, I'm going to write the expected return to the market portfolio here. The expected return, actually, let me write it like this, R sub M. And the book uses Ks, and I do apologize. It's just old habit to use returns with Rs, and they use Ks in the book, but it's the same thing. It's just a little later in the alphabet. I'm always a little later to the party. So R sub M is our expected return to the market portfolio. Now, what would that be? I told you the ideal. You buy every stock in its weight to the whole economy, in proportion to its contribution to the whole economy. Now, that's crazy. What do we use as a proxy for this? S&P 500 index is not bad. But remember, we have to talk about an expected, not historical. We have to look forward in time. What do we expect the Standard & Poor's index to do for the next year? What would it return? And that is actually a decent proxy. If we can get an expected return to the Standard & Poor's 500, decent proxy for the market. 500 of the biggest companies in the country, yeah, that pretty much covers it. And that's an awfully diversified portfolio. You're shaking out maybe about 99% of the diversifiable risk. So that's the one we would probably use. Now, let me look at this. Remember that risk-free rate, R sub F? There it is. And our best proxy, if we need real world data for this, is a T-bill. T-bills are virtually riskless. Well, they're not virtually, they are riskless. Government's not going to go bankrupt. It'll pay off. It'll invade another country and take its money if it has to. It'll tax your ass and then give it back to you. It'll print money. It'll do whatever it has to pay you back. It'll borrow money from the Chinese. It'll take care of you. So the risk-free rate, we usually proxy that theoretical concept with the T-bill, the return to a T-bill. So we've got the theoretical R sub M and the theoretical R sub F, and we have decent ways to estimate those in the real world. Now this R sub M minus R sub F, we would call the market premium. In other words, it is the extra reward you get for bearing the risk of the market portfolio instead of wimping out and taking a risk-free bet. R sub M minus R sub F is your reward for taking the risk of the market portfolio instead of putting your money into something that's perfectly safe. So I could say, okay, well, suppose we expect the S&P 500 next year to pay off at, let's say, 14%, and we expect the risk-free rate to be floating around 2%, then we're saying R sub M minus R sub F is 14% minus 2%, which is 12%. We're saying you get a reward of 12% for taking risk. You get a reward of 12% for taking risk. That's not your total reward. That's your reward for taking risk. That 2%, that's just your reward for giving up your money for a while, not having your cheeseburgers until next year, not having your purchasing that trailer that you were thinking of, double wide indicator, until next year. You got to have be reward for that, man, because you're going to suffer. Where the hell was I? Oh, now, here's what beta does. This beta cat, it's nothing but a percentage. It's like a factor. It tells us by which the factor by which the risk of taking on the market portfolio is magnified when you take on a given stock. So if I write beta of, let me write a beta sub S, the beta of a stock, let's say it's a beta of stock S. If I take that beta times R sub M minus R sub F, what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, this is the premium you are going to get for this stock based upon its non-diversifiable risk. It's like a magnification factor. So suppose that I told you that the beta of a stock was 1.20. I told you. That would say that this stock has 120% of the non-diversifiable volatility of the market portfolio. That's what that's saying. This stock has 120% of the non-diversifiable volatility of the market portfolio. It's a little riskier than the market portfolio. So in that case, I could then say that 1.20 times 14% less 12% comes out to be 14.40%. Okay? So that's saying that the premium for taking the market portfolio is 12%. The premium for taking this stock is 14.4%. You follow me on that? Let's try that again. The premium for the market risk is 12%. Are you okay on that? The premium for the market risk is 12%. The premium for this stock will be 14.4% because this stock is 120% of the risk of the market portfolio. So notice you'll get a little bit more reward. We're not quite done yet, though, because that trailer, you really do deserve it, man. You've earned it. You've worn this hat so long that you've got permanent hat head. You deserve the trailer. So we got to give that to you. So at the end of the day, the capital asset pricing model says we have to reward the investors their return on it. That's just basic. Every investor, any investment, had damn well better give you what a T-bill gives you. Why would you buy it if it won't give you that at least? And that right there, that thing is the capital asset pricing model. CAPM. The return to any stock will be R sub F plus beta sub F times R sub M minus R sub F. That's cap M. We will use it over and over again because that's how we will get the R's, the interest rates we'll use for discounting cash flows. That's how we do it. I'll tell you right now, you go to Google or Standard & Poor's, go to finance.google.com. Just type in any stock, AOL, IBM, anything you could think of. Right there in the top panel, you're going to see they're reporting beta. They report beta right up there at the top. It's right there for you to look at. And it tells you the non-diversifiable risk as a percentage of the risk of the market portfolio premium. Go ahead. Talk to me. Oh, I wrote a 12 there. I'm just testing your ass. It's 2. Thank you. Talking chew gum at the same time. Grr. I was calculating the end of it there. 14 minus 2 is 12, so I wrote the 12 there. Okay, now, last thing. See if you can get the hang of beta. What would be the beta of a treasury bill? Yeah. Oh, you answered that too quick. You're cheating. Yeah, the T-bill would have a beta of 0. Why? Because it has no risk. It has no risk. So it would have a beta of 0. What would be the beta of the market portfolio? Oh, not 100. It would be 1.00, 100%. Because what's the risk of the market portfolio relative to the risk of the market portfolio? Well, that'd be 100%. No, so you can think of like it's like a choice of your risk level. Your portfolio will actually have a beta, which would be the combination of the betas of all the stocks in it. Now, if you are a risk-averse investor, you'd aim at stocks that have low betas. If you're a butch investor, you'd aim at stocks that have high betas. If you are a contrarian, there are actually some securities out there that have negative betas. They're not terribly negative, but you know, you almost think, how would a beta be negative? It would be something that actually runs against the market. Gold mining stocks, you can see sometimes have betas that are negative. There are even some mutual funds, I think, still. I knew an investor, he was really hot into these things called reverse funds. They were actually funds built to have betas that were negative. So because he believed the market's wrong, we're going to hell. Everyone else was saying the market's doing really great. He believed the market was going to hell. So he went into a reverse fund so that he could act contrary to what the market expectation was. And so you can see these negative betas. But mostly you'll see betas like with bonds. You would expect a portfolio that has more bonds in it to have a lower beta because it's a lower risk portfolio. You'd see a portfolio that had a lot of startup companies in it, that would have a high beta. And it really has a lot to do, this has a lot to do with thinking about where you are in your life. Are you in a place in your life where you can put capital at risk? Then go with a mutual fund that has a high beta. Go with stocks that have high betas. But if you are more interested, like when you're 50 and you're thinking about your retirement, if you get that far in your life, you'll be thinking about you will be more interested in betas that are lower. When you talk about people who are in retirement and you're talking about an investment pattern for them, you'd want betas that are very low, just safe, so that because you want that cash flow to be certain to move forward with them. Okay? So that's what we use beta for. And everything that I've taken you through so far really comes down to this interest in these measures of volatility. And internally in a company, we look at the volatility in terms of the coefficient of variation. And externally, we look at things in terms of betas of stocks and betas of projects. As a matter of fact, we can even talk about the beta of a project. Now, here's the last thing. It's a hot debate, and it has been for a number of years. When you hear these companies saying, we're diversifying, because that will lower the risk to our investors. We're a retail company, but we're going to buy an insurance company because that will diversify and make us less risky. Our cash flow is less volatile. The argument is this. Are you on crack? Your investors aren't stupid. They can diversify themselves. Buy different stocks. And they can do it a hell of a lot cheaper than you can. You will have to go through all of the ungodly things of buying a new company, trying to integrate it into this operation, figure out how that company works with your company. You're burning up capital to diversify your portfolio of assets as a corporation. An investor can do that by just calling his broker and saying, buy another stock. You're not doing your investors any favor by diversifying your operations. You can do it for other reasons, but don't blow smoke up my butt and tell me that you're making a barbecue in my honor. This is not for the investors, because the investors can far more cheaply call their broker and say, I want to buy an insurance company stock, rather than having JCPenney go out, as it did, and buy an insurance company and screw the pooch when it did after a few years of that. So you see, that's what we want to ask. When a company buys something that's not very much like it and says, well, this is for diversification purposes, oh, horse crap. No, it's not for that. Don't tell me that. It's for something else. Diversification, an investor can do that himself. Diversify his own portfolio. That's what mutual funds are for. That's what stockbrokers are for. That's what your own common sense is for. And that's all I have for you today. I thank you.